You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. Hardy souls at the back in the actual wilderness listening in. Thank you so much for being here. I am going to kick off with the most basic question that many of us will carry, hearing that you are a mythologist. I know that stories are something that you carry into the world. You are a storyteller, but this subset of stories, myths, I'm not always sure what to do with it. What does it mean? What is your definition of one now, having sat with it for decades?
Okay, thank you, Elizabeth. Can you hear me, folks? Good. Simon Martin. Well, a myth is a very particular type of story in the sense that usually it is a story that explains how we got here in the shape that we are. So there's often the scent of creation in it. And as time goes on and you get the fairy tale tradition and folk tales and things like that, the stories still have their genius, but they're more concerned with, you know, the day-to-day business of a village or the heartbeat of a life with a bit of vocation in it. But myths usually have something of the cosmology, how we got here in the shape that we are. And whenever we are tribally in trouble, that's often a time where the myths get told in a way to remind us of who we actually are. A myth worth its salt is something that you can kind of lean back into, a bit like a kayak. See what I did?
And what is your origin story with them? What's the first one you fell for?
Well, I grew up in Torquay in Devon, and I went to Upton Vale Baptist Church, which really was a thing in the 70s. I'm sure it still is. But the reality is that although I loved stories from the Bible, my first great enswoonment with myth and fairy tale was walking back from church, where we'd go through a little copse next to the house where I lived in, and I'd hear stories of King Arthur. I'd hear about this extraordinary character called Maid Marian, who I had a wild crush on. And so it was Arthurian stories, Irish stories, and I loved them in the way you love something when you're six. But a myth is a story that will walk with you throughout your whole life. So the concerns you have when you're 60, the myth should still be talking to you about them. They grow deeper as we do. So my first loves remain my first loves in many ways. Yeah.
I was speaking recently with Dr. Sharon Blackie, who her particular love is fairy tales, but you're working in similar fashions in terms of digging in deep history to bring us the stories that we need. And I admitted to her that I feel a bit like my childhood was mythically malnourished. I knew the myths through, I knew the Arthur myth through The Sword in the Stone, right? I knew the Disney-fied, pretty-fied versions a little bit, but I didn't have any of this heritage told to me, passed down to me. And my guess is lots of people my age and younger, maybe all of you, feel that we had mythless childhoods at the time when we most needed them. What happened? Why did we make that cultural move, do you think?
Well, that would be an enormous question that would take the rest of Greenbelt to really get to grips with.
It's all right, Salim.
It begins with the Industrial Revolution, really. It begins with the Cultural Commons. It begins with all sorts of things. But one way or another, we have become very passive in the way we receive entertainment. So in other words, I'm sure many of you have just seen it. Christopher Nolan has just had a crack at The Odyssey. I have to say, I found it, as an artist, visually sumptuous, but emotionally vacuous. I didn't care. And the interesting thing as an oral storyteller is if I was telling you The Odyssey now, which takes 5 days, just
I
so
did
we're
say
clear.
Buckle in.
If I was telling The Odyssey now, I would give you a very bare bones description because it means your own imagination has to do an enormous amount of work. You can't freeze frame me and stop. I can't tell the story in the same way over and over again. And what that does is it puts real onus on your imagination to do a lot of the heavy lifting. And I think it is a great impoverishment when we stop doing that and we just want things that we can freeze frame to be the same thing delivered over and over again.
Yeah. As I was thinking about that question, it really did link to me with these, you know, the sense of a secular frame, modernity as one which closes the lid. You use this picture from one of your stories about blocking the smoke hole.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas a myth holds together heaven and earth, that there is a way that it breaks that buffering. Why do they do that? What's going on?
Why do we buffer?
What is it about a myth that can break us out of some of these imaginative flatness I feel so constrained by so much of the time?
Have you ever read a poem or heard a piece of music or just heard someone speaking and said, I think I have to change my life. Everywhere I go, I meet people looking for a deeper kind of life. The news is good. The news is really good. There's an old Aboriginal idea that modernity is only 3 days deep. It's only 3 days deep. So take yourself out into the wilds and you may discover what the old Irish philosopher John Moriarty used to call your bush soul. Jesus did it, slipped out early in the morning, hiding out in the wild and lonely places. That's where he chose to pray. How gorgeous is that? Myths challenge us to live deeper, to have a sense of vocation. When the knights ride out from Camelot, they're always going out to seek something to then bring back and deepen the culture. In the Bible, we have the story of Ruth and Naomi and the idea of being a kinsman redeemer. In other words, as you grow up, what are the things that you are going to defend? What are the things that you were going to care about? What are going to be the things? How are you going to earn your name? Myth asks these difficult questions.
I want to ask you about black elk, because you've gestured to being raised in a Baptist church, kind of walking out of there because, is it a fair summary to say it sort of bored you?
It bored me, a little bit. Yeah.
And
I thought church was bad for your health.
Yeah. Yep. No comment. You were a musician, and then you met this figure of black elk who was such a turning point in your life. Who was he, and what mark did he leave on you?
Great question. Wallace Black Elk was a Lakota Sioux medicine man who, funnily enough, is the grandson of a guy called Nicholas Black Elk, who wrote a very important book called Black Elk Speaks. And the rub is that Nicholas Black Elk was a Catholic. This wasn't necessarily what you put together with the Lakota, but his grandson was a ceremonial teacher in that tradition that I met when I was about 25. I was briefly around him. We weren't close. I wasn't special. He didn't pat me on the head. I just traveled with him. And it was Wallace, ironically, I was on a long walkabout from Christianity. It lasted 30 years, really, almost until I was 50. And it was Wallace, in the darkness of something called a sweat lodge, which is like the hottest sauna you can possibly imagine, he said, don't give up on the little hippie guy. That's how he put it. He said, he hasn't given up on you. Now, that was disturbing and very unsexy.
Did you know who he was talking about?
Yeah, I did. I knew instantaneously who he was talking about. And I thought, if you're referring to the Galilee Druid who I'm on the run from, I'm not listening to this. I want to go and get my chakras balanced. I'm off. But he stayed with me because Wallace was the first real human being I'd ever met. The day I met Wallace, it was just like this. It was pouring with rain and we were lighting a fire. It was important that the fire remained lit. And he said, talk to the clouds and it'll stop raining. And I said, I really don't think I have that kind of relationship with them. And he said, check this out. And Wallace pulled out a pipe. It's called a chinupa. And he aimed the pipe at the clouds. And for about 10 minutes, he spoke to the clouds as if he was reunited with the girl he first loved when he was 16. He spoke with subtlety, tenderness, emotion. And then he turned to me, and this is when it became a rather bad dream. He said, look, I don't even come from here. You have a crack. I don't know if you can remember being 23, but when I was 23, my mouth was a prison where words went to die. What initiated me as a young man in the early 90s was sarcasm. It wasn't open, heartfelt praise making. And sure enough, the clouds did part long enough for us to do the business that we wanted to do. But from then on, I realized that language and myth and story, it seemed to be a contact sport. It seemed, you learn this in fairy tales, if you have a desire or a longing, until you speak them, they're not quite true. And there's an energy that comes in when you announce the intention that seems to have a bit of an oomph to it. So Wallace was the first, I felt, other than Billy Connolly, I have to give it to Billy Connolly, other than Billy Connolly, he was the first real human being I felt I'd ever met.
That line from your book has really stayed with me, and it chimes. I spend my life obsessed with how do we be becoming the kind of people the world needs? How do we grow up our souls? You know, how do we meet this moment with some agency and some joy and some play and some power rather than being paralyzed or hoarding or finger pointing? And so that thread goes through the book, and you use the phrase, how do we get made? What does it take to become a real human being? And in some ways you can't sum that up in an answer, but what are some of the themes that you continually digging into around it?
So yes, this book is called Liturgies of the Wild, Myths That Make Us. Now, I will respond to the question, but I'm just going to go back in time. It's 40 years I was at Greenbelt, 40 years ago. So this is why I've come to this loveless bit of the country, is to actually remember. I fell in love at Greenbelt. So that's part of what makes a real human being, is figuring out what to love. In 1988, in the old days here, this was the weekend when you got your GCSE results. So it was a whole bunch of us queuing up for the phone, and it was just over there. Phoned, and my mum and dad, who were very compassionate about it, said, you know, hasn't gone so well. So I'm sitting sobbing uncontrollably outside the tent, and the girl next door unzipped her tent, hearing the commotion, and said, you know, what's the matter? And I can tell you, losing all my exams to meet her was worth it, you know? So I suppose falling in love for many of us is our first encounter with almost a religious experience. You know, you're just in a bigger, more numinous world. But then you get older and you also you're going to experience grief. You're going to experience betrayal. You're going to experience illness. You're going to experience depression. And from a mythic perspective, all of those things are not wastes of time. All of them are monsters or angels to be encountered. And how you choose to deal with the detritus that gets chucked up at you, whether that diminishes you or actually in the end makes you a character of substance, that's what those stories are about. So my life has been collecting and gathering stories for me, but also, so I'm a dad. So I would have a 21-year-old daughter. And for some of that period, it was just me and her. So I wanted my daughter to be around stories that made her feel, not that she's waiting for a prince to arrive or any of that modern stuff, that she actually had, you know, agency and depth and connection to mystery in her own life. And, you know, she's carried that with her. They've been in her saddlebags. You know, she just graduated from film school. So now I can see her picking up themes far more efficiently than I ever did.
No pressure, but is there one of those you'd like to tell us?
Oh, my goodness. I don't think right this second, but if you give me a moment, probably towards the end,
okay,
there'll be something that can announce itself.
Okay. So part of, while you were still running from the Galilean Druid, one of the key themes in your How Do We Make a Human is the wild, is this initiatory, yes, going into the world. And you are a wilderness rites of passage guide. Could you say what that is?
I can. A wilderness rites of passage guide. The description actually is fairly accurate. All around the world, for thousands of years, cultures have understood that often at adolescence, it's a very good thing to leave the village, to leave the town for about a week, spend usually 3 to 4 days fasting in a forest or in a desert or up even in a mountain and just listening to what God has to say to you. We are filled with distractions. We're just filled with them. So over the last 30 years, it's 30 years again this month since I started training as a wilderness guide up in Snowdonia, it is very simply a 4-day fast in a wild place. I have just got back from one. We were talking the other day. I lead something called the Peregrini Sit, which is the process I know very well, but it has Christ at the center. It has Jesus at the center. So hearing the Gospel of John in an oak grove is a very different experience to hearing it in the church that I grew up in. But as far as we know, God absolutely delights in his creation. So it's an amazing thing to be doing that work out there. So that's really what a wilderness vigil is.
And why does it have to be in the wild? Why can't I do it in my bedroom?
Interesting that, isn't it? I mean, to a degree, if you are incredibly spiritually developed, possibly you could. But most of us need to be delightfully untethered. We need to get in touch with something. This is the way I would put it. As long as you remain in your bedroom, the only thing that will mirror yourself back to yourself is something made by humans. But when you are out in an old growth forest or sleeping by a river, God starts to mirror you through his creation, not just stuff that people have made. It is a deeper moment. Some of you will know the poet W.B. Yeats, and he has this fabulous line. He says, "I'm looking for the face I had before the world was made." That is outrageously poetic. Don't stretch it on the rack of obvious interpretation. I'm looking for the face I had before the world was made. I want to live in a mythopoetic universe. Mythopoetic is a word that people again often say, well, what does that actually mean? What I'd say it means is this: the big myths and the life you and you and you and me are having right now are interwoven if we just have the eyes to see it. So that for me is what I spend my time thinking about.
I want to ask you about what happened at the end of one of your own wilderness vigils a few years ago, but I want to caveat it with both the power and the wildness of stories and the way they can begin to feel less wild through retelling in certain ways. You have a beautiful bit in the book where you are encouraging people to tell their own story. One of the things you say about becoming a real human is you need to know and own your story. Yeah. But someone's telling their story and you say, no, tell it in a new way. And that's what unlocks it. But you've told your testimony in Christian language. I've told mine, and there's complexity around it. So I want to invite you to tell whatever feels alive today, not whatever you think we are waiting to hear.
That was a wonderful thing that you just said, Elizabeth. Can you rescue your own thrown away stories? Isn't that an interesting? There's things that have happened to you that you are not attending to. You're not taking them seriously because they happen to you, so you don't rate them. I was being interviewed the other day and somebody said to me, they said, "You're having such an interesting life, Dr. Shaw." And I said, "Well, so are you. You're just not paying any bloody attention." You know what I mean? Honestly, this, you could create a numinous bit of storytelling just about what happens to you over this weekend. Just attend to the grace. We are beset with bad news. We are neurotic and we're tired and we're exhausted and we are constantly staring into the underworld. And what myth says about that is be careful because you will experience burnout. You need to do it artfully. You need to do it with beauty. And you need to do it in the presence of something that is bigger than you. So I was almost 50. I'm a bit older than that now. And I had been living as a mythologist and a storyteller. Nobody told me I could do these kind of things for a living when I was a kid. I simply had no idea such terms existed. But somehow it had happened. I'd lived in a tent for 4 years just trying to tune. Seamus Heaney has a word. He says you've got to tune your ear. I was trying to tune my ear to these stories and particularly their relationship to landscape and nature. And I thought, what do I do on my 50th birthday to reconnect with all this work I've been doing? And I did a 101-day vigil in a Dartmoor forest. That is no simple thing to begin. It's a long time. And on the very last night of that, I had a dramatic and startling encounter with Christ. I think, to be honest, when I set out on that vigil, if someone had said to me, what would you seek from it? I'd seek, well, I'd like to be married to the wild. She's always been my bride, really. That's what I wish for. But in the end, what I found is what I now call the mossy face of Christ. And some of you will know the story, some of you won't, but it was overwhelming what happened. It was absolutely overwhelming. It was like some, I remember at the time thinking, this is like something out of the Old Testament. And do you know what happened the next day? Lockdown. Lockdown. So I had 18 months to chew on the strangeness of what I had encountered out in the forest. How can it be? How has Christianity become so cautious, so safe, so anaesthetized that I grew up not really understanding that the God we worshipped on a Sunday was born a fugitive. He dies an outlaw, and then he has the audacity to come back. That is badass. I mean, it's just a hot ticket. I mean, what on earth are you talking about? And so it took me that time, ironically, for lockdown to sort of chew on and ruminate, because I didn't want this to be happening to me. I wanted to be a Sufi. I didn't want this to happen, but it did happen. And just before my 50th birthday, as Lewis would say, you know, the most reluctant convert in England, I bent my head and I realized that the thing I'd encountered in the forest was nearer to me than my own breath. And it's been between me and you and several other hundred people now. It's not been a comfortable experience, Christianity. It is an encounter of continual exposure. And I am constantly confronted, not just with the grace of living, but also the state that we're in and the state that I'm in, the state that I'm in. And so every day, you know, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. That's a good place to begin the day. I actually begin the day. Do you know how Mother Teresa used to begin every day? She'd wake up, she'd open one mythical Mother Teresa eye, and she'd say, hello, Jesus. So I wake up before I go into the loo and go, hello, Jesus. And then come back. And so it's a great and terrifying thing in midlife to have to effectively give it all away and just see what lands. Because I knew enough about the Bible. I knew enough about the Gospels that Jesus will talk to absolutely anybody. Anybody. But be very careful, because that conversation could cost you. It could cost you, it could give you more freedom, more reality, more creativity, more beauty. Isn't that amazing? But at the same time, for my immediate friends, it looked as if I was having a slow, protracted nervous breakdown. You know the look. I was very weepy for a long time. A lot of tears, a lot of sorrow needed to announce itself. So that was about 5 years ago. There was an immediate cost for that encounter. You know, I've often said in the last couple of years, people love you when you're looking for something. They hate you when you find something. So it was, you know, there were, I lost a publisher, I lost friends, I lost a certain amount of income. But the big, to be honest, that isn't what matters. What matters for me is my relationship with my daughter. How does my kid feel about this? Is this okay? Is this not okay? Do we stay in dialogue? And I'm Russian Orthodox. So it's not, you know, it's a very strong flavor. It's a strong flavor. And that in itself requires some unpacking. So it is a new and interesting universe that I'm in.
If your daughter was here and yes. I asked her, how has your dad changed in 5 years? What do you think she'd say?
Well, that, you know, that obviously you can't possibly say anything positive about yourself. she might say he's changed, but probably not through his own intention. I seem to have the capacity to be mildly kinder to people. Now, there's a lot of you here, I'm sure, that endure... No, sorry, that's the wrong word. Don't endure other people. You enjoy other people. oddly, for someone that has such a public life as I do, most of it is a sort of an endurance, because I have a particular skill set that involves being in public, but my heart is profoundly introverted. And the reason that I ran from Christianity was that I felt that Western Christianity is often very extroverted, and I needed something to feed the deep interior of me. And myths and stories seem to do that without, certainly, I don't know what it was like for you, Elizabeth, but when I was growing up, there was an enormous pressure on, do you believe? And belief, yeah, I do believe. Of course I believe. But that belief in itself, I want to be sensual and unfolding and poetic and not stretched on the rack of exegesis. And when I was younger, it came, how on earth could I have had any cohesive thoughts about the Trinity when I was 8 years old? I didn't. So I'm finding my way back in, and mercifully, I've been around women and men that care about me and are on a similar journey themselves. There's something seems to be happening at the moment.
What from the wild would you like to bring into the church? What would you like to say to the church from your 30 years of other myths and other places?
Well, strangely enough, somebody who I would dare to say I could call a friend and cares for me is Rowan Williams. So Rowan has started telling more stories. Seriously, you should come to, there's an event Rowan and I are doing. Oh, I haven't asked him yet, but it's in December. It's called Wild Christ. You should come. It's on Dartmoor. We've got a few places left. And often you say, oh, you must know Malcolm Guite, surely. Guitey. So I think Malcolm will come. But anyway, Rowan is telling more fairy stories, Welsh stories. He talks about Taliesin. And we've got fairy tale people telling stories from the Old Testament. And there's just a bit of ground where many of my friends who you could describe as Christian curious are going, okay, this Jacob and Esau thing. Tell me about Jacob and Esau. At the very same time, I have Christian friends who really didn't think it was even safe to open a book of Grimm's fairy tales and say, okay, this is filled with a certain kind of wisdom. So it feels like a hinge moment for me where people are talking across the fence to each other, and I love that.
Yeah. I'm really aware of the crossing currents of whatever this moment we're in spiritually and culturally. And I think you and I are both seeing a lot of people for whom Christianity was not a box of wisdom they were ever prepared to open, sometimes for some very good reasons, beginning to sort of edge up sideways and blow a bit of the dust off and like just cautiously peek under the lid. And I'm, one of my great joys is being in conversation with those people. And coming to a place like Greenbelt, I'm reminded that there's lots of people who have drawn deeply from that box of wisdom, have been in church and just can't bear it anymore, right? Greenbelt's the only place they still have faith in, right? The church itself, its institutional failures, its power hungriness, its flattening, it's the way it gets caught up in all of these dynamics. And we would point at different unhealthy ones depending on our temperament and politics and background, but we can all point at some unhealthy ones. As someone who's been, was raised in the church, was out and has come back in, either from your experience or from your stories, how do we live in the tension of the beauty and the promise of the church and its like almost unrivaled capacity to wound us?
Got it. Okay, this is responding to your last question and that question. And as usual, it's just something that happened to me recently. I went into a church in Devon. It's called Cockington Church. The reason it's significant to me is my father proposed marriage to my mother on the just outside. They'd known each other for 14 days. That's how we roll. So 14 days and dad asked me, but this is the thing. And please, I don't know if there's anybody, you know, this is what, it's an amazing thing. I go into the church, it's early in the morning. I'm the only person there. And I notice that the pulpit does not look at all like the rest of the church. It looks, doesn't look like it's English. It seems to have scars on it. It's a very strange, gnarly looking thing in a very ornate church. As I'm looking, a voice behind me in the dark says, "Are you looking at what I think you're looking at?" And I turn, and there's an old fella. There's an old fella. And I said, I am. I said, I'm looking at the pulpit. And this is the important part for your question. He said, it's not a pulpit at all. It's a crow's nest. And I said, what? And he said, that originally was a crow's nest that was taken from a Spanish pirate ship 500 years ago when it came into Torbay. So every single priest, every single speaker who was crawled up to talk to that small parish is speaking from a crow's nest. So imagine for a minute what that crow's nest has seen. That crow's nest could have gone past African deserts. It could have looked out and seen the gold tops of a mosque. It could have seen the forests of the Spear Danes. In other words, if you're in a crow's nest, you see the big picture. You see the wild, illuminating majesty of God's creation. And I know that in the years I have left, and God willing, let them be long, what I want to do is to get my Christian mind crow's nested. And I would encourage you to do the same. In other words, trust the strange eccentricity of your own conscience. That's the place to start. If you feel far from God at the moment, just for a week, allow God to be your conscience and see what happens. You'll end up in some wild places. So actually, that image that what we need from lay people, we need from older people, we need from younger people, is to speak from the crow's nest of God's imagination. Allow yourself to have some big, wonderful pictures. C.S. Lewis says in The Pilgrim's Regress, every 400 years or so, Mother Kirk, the church, almost by design, starts to collapse. And it is at that moment that it's what Lewis calls the big pictures start to fall into the imagination of you or you or you or you. And together with God's help, something refines itself. So those are the kind of images that I feel really stirred by. I sat up late with my mum last night. My mum's about to hit 80, and she seems to have taken one of those Benjamin Button pills. She seems to be going backwards. She plays bass in a rock band. She has Converse boots, and she's a phenomenal painter. But mum and I were saying, I said to mum, I said, you know, I could talk to you about Maximus the Confessor, and I could talk to you about Pseudo Dionysus, but I want to talk to you about a crow's nest, or I want to tell you about this fox that I saw the other day. And my mum says, well, I want to tell you about this particular paint I'm using at the moment. And we are speaking theologically, but in our own way. And those are the things that are exciting me at the moment.
I want to try and talk to you about, so a big theme of your work for most of your life has been land, has been the stories of place, of soil, of peoples, of centuries, these riches of tradition that come from, you know, you would tell a Slavic story or one of the Lakota Nation stories or a British story. And there's a chapter in your book where you're trying incredibly carefully to hold the tension around that, the sense of place and particularity and culture and stories that have for most of history been how people got made, how people grew up their souls, and the sharp edges of that when they turn to draw a sharp line around who gets to tell those stories who gets to live on that land and who gets to claim that soil. It's a huge question, but I'd love to just, I hope in a space where we can have soft hearts to the tenderness of this, what can myth and stories teach us in this time about how to hold together the tensions around those questions?
I, last weekend, was not at my mother's 80th year. I was with a guy called Satish Kumar, who was hitting 90. Do you know Satish? You know. And Satish, I said to him, we're getting to a point where we have to ask, what kind of world are we leaving for Satish Kumar? 90 years old. I thought that was funny. What kind of world are we leaving for Satish Kumar? Now, Satish is interesting because he left India at 8 years old. He became a monk, and then he became involved with a walk he did without money to all of the four nuclear powers at that point, just to petition them not to hit the button. And each one of them, he brought a tea bag. And he said, please put the tea bag next to the red button. And just before you strike, please have a bag of tea. You know, have a cup of tea. Genius, genius. Now, here's the thing. Satish lives in Devon. He lives on Dartmoor. He's clearly a son of the Moors. We claim him utterly. The land claims him utterly, but he comes from somewhere else. I think that is glorious. I don't think having the bones of your dead in a place means you are necessarily of a place. You're from a place. But to be of a place is still to be listening to it. And to be of a place, you can turn up. Have you ever gone into an old growth forest or some little copse at the edge of a field and you've gone, oh, I feel connected to this. I am profoundly moved. I want to come back. I'm in conversation with this place. So I, as a storyteller, have to be very aware of what you could call cultural appropriation. So what I don't do is, you know, liberally pick and mix on Google stories from lots of different cultures. However, I am related to certain charities, Inuit charities, where I've spent years talking back and forth with their elders, and they've said, well, nobody else is telling those stories. So what I do is I just make sure if I tell an Inuit story or a Siberian story, there is an immediate money, monthly actually, it doesn't matter whether I tell the stories or not, goes back into their communities where they're training young people to become storytellers again. So that's where I sort of pick my way carefully.
And it feels like, how long is it we've been saying we're in a very meaningful, profound, turbulent time? What, like 15 years? 20 years it's felt like? And then I wonder, has it always felt like this? Thomas Merton was writing in the 1960s and he was talking about, he called it a thin, shallow spiritual awakening, because I think it was about the atomic bomb at the time was driving people back to church and the work of the spirit that was underneath it. But it's certainly the story we are telling is that this is a turbulent time, that the climate crisis and the rapid rollout of AI in particular as like presenting issues probably all on the front of our minds, that we need to find ways to make meaning of collectively, that we need to become real humans in the face of. Where would you give us some clues as to where to start looking to dig for wisdom?
I'm going to say something now that seems so astonishingly obvious, you will question my intelligence. But when I'm asked about AI, and when I'm asked about the machine, and when I'm asked about technology, I come back to a very simple premise that you get through all fairy tales. Have a handmade life. Have a handmade life. In a Russian fairy tale, when you want to court your own soul, who we always see is a woman, her name is Vasilisa and she lives at the edge of the world. And if I mention her, Asai has to go through the tent, so we'll try this again. Her name is Vasilisa. Oh. Vasilisa, who lives at the very edge of the world, and you have to cross 9 oceans to get her attention. Now, the thing about Vasilisa is, the only gifts she'll accept from you are things that have been made by hand. They don't have to be incredibly ornate. She needs to see your beautiful failures. Your beautiful failures lovingly attended to for so long they become a devotional act. And then you begin to have a soulful life. Then you begin to have a soulful life. And to have a soulful life is to have a life. I mean, thank God it's raining, you know? Thank God it's raining after the last 60 days. This is just a wonderful thing that's happening at this moment. There's an old Mayan idea that the substance of rain is female and the movement of rain is masculine. Isn't that an interesting thought? That both, all of these things, I don't hang my soul on any of these little things, but I find them poetic. I find them poetic. So a handmade life, what does that look like? Be on your phone less. Turn it off. But
throw it in a river.
But if you entirely cease relationship, you can go the Amish route if you want. You can do that. But you lose your capacity to do what Paul says, which is to test the spirits of the age. In other words, have discernment. Think about this word, pharmakon. Pharmakon means the poison and the remedy. The poison and the remedy. So within technology, mercifully, we can see the trouble. But at the same time, with my own phone and computer and work, I'm constantly creating senseless acts of beauty out of it. I'm constantly doing furtively good works here and there with my phone. You know, you've taken something and you've done something else with it. But it does mean, and I'm sure it's in the book, you make a covenant with limit. One of the things in the Orthodox tradition is there's an innumerable amount of fasting that we have to get up to. You know, I haven't always done so well at that myself, but we live in a culture that is used to feasting, but we don't know so much about fasting. And that balance for me in fasting from technology, no bad thing.
There's a line in your book that I just want to ask you to expand on because it stayed with me. We are heavily defended against an experience of our own beauty.
We're heavily defended against an experience of our own beauty. So what we would do, if you were at my school, we'd now spend 4 hours having a back and forth about what we think beauty is. So when I say beauty, it doesn't mean that you look like George Clooney. What's the new fella, Jason Momoa? Momoa? It's not that. It's not that. It's a beauty. I remember somebody saying to me once, the thing about beauty, it's not what is beautiful, it's about the effect it has. Because when you are affected by beauty, you're tenderized by it. And in Irish myth, there's a fella called Diarmuid of the Love Spot. He has a mark on his face, and if you see the mark, you can't help but fall in love with him. Now, the thing is, Diarmuid, yes, we admit he has a lot of freckles, which is appealing in Irish mythology. It's all about the freckles in Irish myth. But we all have a love spot. And when we talk about what we're passionate about, when we talk about how we want to live, when we're laughing at a story that one of our children told us, our love spot reveals itself. So I think in a world that continually feeds us stories that want to seduce us, not to show us actually, yeah, we're fallen, befuddled people, but we're occasionally gorgeous. We're occasionally swashbuckling. Occasionally we're daring and we're brave, and occasionally we earn our name. I'm in favor of that. And there's something about oral storytelling that sort of short circuits people's own imagination, and they come out and go, well, I just had to create most of that story myself. And then they take that storytellery kind of mind and they start to see it in many other areas of their life.
Wonderful. I'm going to come to some audience questions in just a moment. So this is your few minute warning to be pondering those. But I just want to finish with the question. I've heard you use the phrase rewilding Christianity and rewilding the church. If that happened in 5 more years' time, what would we see?
Well, I think we'd see an openness to the Holy Spirit. You know, I'd be a bit of a fan. I think even at times when I felt estranged from God and not really having a sense of who Yeshua was, I know when the feeling's here. I know when the feeling's here, and so do you. So I think we'd have a bit of that. I'm a veteran of something called the Charismatic Movement. So that was some wild stuff flying through the room in the summer of 83, you know. And so I'm a fan of that. And that's interesting because people say, well, how can you be a fan of that if you're an Orthodox Christian? Surely, you know, everything since the schism has been utterly in error. Well, I live in a family, just so we're absolutely clear, with an evangelical brother, a charismatic Catholic sister, and my mum and dad I would describe as sort of errant, out in the bushes Baptists. So in other words, if you want to remain loving and respectful, you have to not get tied up with too much sectarian Christianity. Lewis had a point when he talked about mere Christianity. He really had a point. You know, can we gather around the creed or not? And I can. And so that's a wonderful thing for me. Personally, I'm developing an idea called the Mary. Think of Mary being connected to the word Mary. Think of it being connected to the Merry Outlaws of Robin Hood and Maid Marian. And to be honest with you, I'd like to be with folks under canvas. We should just go full on tabernacle for a few years. Let's just go for it, man. Why not? Why not? So that's my kind of plan, is to be around. At the moment, I'm telling a lot of the stories from the Bible. I have a kind of prayer rope from Genesis up to the road to Emmaus, where I'm telling those stories not so much in a chapter and verse style, but as if I was telling you a fairy tale, because I believe that God still speaks through those stories and wild things happen. So I would encourage all of you, whatever communities you come from, wouldn't it be a wild thing? Autumn is coming. Well, it's arriving, actually. Why don't you have a fire in about 3 weeks' time and one of you just have a crack at telling one of these old stories? Think of Narnia. Think of that moment where the White Queen has frozen all the animals and Aslan comes with his great ruach and blows on the breath. In the Bible, there will be a story there that has become, it's frozen for you. And by telling it, you can breathe something on it and you're going to discover something that I don't think you'll get if you just read it over and over.
Martin, thank you so much. Who would like to ask a question?
Okay. Just checking this is on. Yeah, so we'll do the normal Greenbelt way of get as many people as we can. We'll get a variety of people. And if we can keep questions nice and brief so we can get plenty of questions. And I'll bring the microphone as much to you as I possibly can. Okay, okay, first person.
Hiya, Martin. Thank you so much for a really inspiring talk. I'm someone who's errant and out in the woods from Christianity myself, partly because two of the core beliefs of it, namely like the Immaculate Conception and like the resurrection of a human, I just don't believe are factually true. Yuval Harari says that not being true or believable is one of the things that makes a religion like flourish, because it is has a cost to join in the community. And it really binds that community together. As someone who is steeped in myth and such, like, how do you feel about, for example, those two claims in mainstream Christianity relating to the concept of myth or binding the community together around certain beliefs?
Great question. So that was partially to do with an attraction towards Christianity, but then you bump into things like the Immaculate Conception or the resurrection. Are you meant to get your heads around them as literal events? Are they incredibly symbolic? Where do you pitch your tent? Now, the reality is, I'm one of these signs and wonders guys who just... it's just not a struggle for me to lean back into those things as numinous experiences. And on certain days, I think of them as literal events. I don't believe that the kerfuffle called the Acts of the Apostles could have happened if Jesus had actually just died. I just don't think that there would be that response. I certainly don't think that amount of disciples would have ended up losing their own lives. However, I'm massively sympathetic to your position. The Immaculate Conception, I don't think about it much. I just don't, because someone was saying to me the other day, they said, Dr. Shaw, how do you hold all of this immense Christian cosmology in your head? And I said, well, I just don't. I said, imagine going back to the Odyssey, imagine Odysseus has just had the boat wrecked and he's hanging on a couple of planks. That's me in Christianity. I'm hanging on these two planks, but I've looked at these two planks and I've realized that these two planks are a cross. They're a cross. I tuck my boat in behind Jesus, and there comes a point where he's so compelling, everything else falls away. And until that moment happens, I'm very limited in what I can do talking to somebody else, because it is such a profoundly... it's an odd word I'm going to use, shamanistic experience. It's he's the big shaman I was waiting for. He's the hint. He's the fullness of the hint that's in all of these other stories. And I found, go out and have a look at the night sky and go, I'd like to know you better. And then expect a response. But that's where I would begin. I don't think about those particular things, because the wonderful thing about probably many functioning religions, but I want to drill down into Christianity, is that they can be appreciated on so many different levels. Yeah.
Thank you. Sorry, just pause and then the rest of the room can benefit from your question. Thank you. And tell us your name.
Hi, my name's Max. Thank you so much for your talk. What do I do with the way we use the word myth as a way of describing something that's not true? Oh, don't believe that, it's a myth. Oh, really? Oh, that's just an urban myth. I want to be able to tap into what you're talking about. But the way we use myth is synonymous with untruth. And I'm looking for truth.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. It's funny that the facts of the matter very rarely get near the truth of the matter. I'm currently grieving the death of a friend of mine. There's a musician called Glenn Hansard who died very unexpectedly about 3 weeks ago. And the facts of his death are one thing, but the truth of his death, the reality of his death, the myth of his death, I am incredibly struck by because we were so tight and so close. So when I hear it all the time, people say, oh, so you just traffic in lies, do you? You traffic in lies. That's what a myth is. Well, of course not. Myth, ironically, enounces a much more profound form of truth than a statistical report. And so it is hard for people to get their heads around the word being used. And in a strange way, we're back to that phrase I used 10 minutes ago, the pharmacon. So you've got the remedy and you've got the poison in one go. The myth as a fiction, not interesting. But the myth as a very pronounced way of announcing truth, that's my experience of it. And for many cultures, before we were literate, the place that we secreted wisdom was in oral storytelling. Because as this story passed from culture to culture, or tribe to tribe to tribe, or family to family to family, they were story comes from storehouse. It's like a bird in a nest. So all these good things are passed in there, which is why we don't have lots of stories about the day that was like the day before, because they're not memorable enough to be remembered. In an oral culture where retention is not endless, I'm finding at 55, I can't remember anybody's names. I couldn't remember George Clooney the other day. I was going, you know, the actor, as if that helps, you know. So the actor, the big one, the big one. So I hope you could call them myth, folktale, fairy tale. There's always going to be some people who it's just not their cup of tea. They're not wired like that. But if you have a romantic frame of mind, I don't mean romantic like a schmaltzy movie. I mean romantic like a deep sense of the word. You will be inevitably drawn to people that are living a mythic kind of life. You know, your life is remarkable. Pay attention to it.
I feel like we should crowd surf the mic.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm blessed with the name Rhiannon, which itself carries quite a lot.
Queen of the wild horses.
That's the one. I'm particularly concerned about the climate crisis. And for a number of years now, I've felt that something that's contributed to that in our society is that we've lost touch with our stories of the land and our myths and legends, particularly in England. We've still got it in the peripheries of our country, in Cornwall and Wales and Scotland, but the English stories, we grew up without them. How do we get them back? Where do we find them? Are they gone? Do we have to make our own stories, or can you tell us, help us to find them again?
Well, you know, this is leading to an unashamed plug of my West Country School of Myth and Story, where you will indeed absolutely positively find those stories. So I have a big house on the edge of Dartmoor. I don't own it and I don't live in it. Blessedly, Americans come and they think I live in this Agatha Christie-esque house, but I don't. I rent it. But what we do over 5 weekends is we explore folk tales, fairy tales, myths, trickster stories, and you know, there's amazing stories from Dorset. There's amazing stories from Sussex. There's amazing stories from
Swatham.
Swatham, of course. Now, what is... It's the Wirral. Yes, of course, it's the Wirral, just underneath Liverpool. There's amazing stories around the Wirral. So, in other words, almost wherever you put your thumb, you will find stories. I'd encourage any chance you get, go and see oral storytelling. Go and see a traditional storyteller telling them, because there's a kind of a wallop and a charisma that isn't there when you read them out of a book. And do remember, when you read books on fairy tales, generally you're reading a kind of shorthand. You know, when you're in court and someone's typing really quickly, that's what those books are like. So a real storyteller, it's like opening up a concertina. They expand and develop and they have little details because they want you to invite them back the next night. You know, no storyteller ever gets to the point. That's an anathema for us. We want to stretch it out.
Thank you so much, Martin. You spoke a bit about the charismatic movement and signs and wonders, and with the kind of stuff stinging from Soul Survivor in my ears, and the kind of abuse and manipulation there. I wonder if, how can rewilding, how can stories sort of talk back to that culture or inoculate us against sort of manipulation and kind of power-hungry leaders?
Yeah, very good question. I've been asked about this a lot recently. Well, unfortunately, as long as human beings gather and deep feelings are experienced, there is always going to be a shadow to that. And one of the things that Christianity, especially the evangelical movement, are terrible at is an analyzing or even understanding their own shadow. They're awful at it. It's embarrassing. They are illiterate. Not everything, I'm afraid, is to be prayed about. Some things need psychology. Some things need therapeutic process. It's just a fact. It's just, goodness me. And so actually, knowledge of your own duplicitousness, knowledge of your own ego, knowledge of your peculiar ambitions, you've got to be wary, I'm afraid, of that. So I don't think there's any kind of pill we can swallow that suddenly creates a place where we're not dealing with the kind of things you've announced, which have also, of course, gone on in Buddhism. They've gone on in religions, anywhere where there's deep feeling and charismatic leaders. I don't mean charismatic as the movement. I mean people that you're drawn to. You know, Christianity was a personality cult for a bit. You know what I mean? He was a very arresting fellow, this Jesus. So we go with caution. To repeat what I said earlier on, test the spirits of the age. I am not in favor of religious leaders having much power, really, honestly. I'm just not.
I've just looked at the time. We've got time for one more question, I'm afraid. I'm going to go down here. Nice, easy access. We've got 3 minutes left.
Front row privileges.
Thank you, Martin. Great. Fantastic. My Mesmond. So I'm asking this question because this time last year I had my mossy Jesus moment at Greenbelt. And for the last 12 months, I've been struggling with the next step, which is sort of like finding church and finding a church and that sort of whole bit. Could you talk through what your next steps were after that and how you ended up at the sort of the church or the community or whatever you're at?
Yes, I will do. So it's one thing, isn't it, to have a deep religious experience or a spiritual experience, but where do you land it? Where do you park it? Where are you going to go? You know, I've got a bit of there's a lovely Irish word I keep using, graw. Graw means it's a bit like love, but it's slightly subtler. It's like having a soft spot. If you want to see if someone will go out with you, just say, I've got a bit of a graw for you. And they won't be overwhelmed. They can just kind of hold it between. I have a graw, actually, for house churches. I have a love of where one or two are gathered, three are gathered, amazing things can happen. However, after I'd had this experience in the forest, I was then baptized by a man who's really, he's called Peter Owen Jones. He's part goat, part priest. Perfect. It's just perfect. He's a fella. He's a priest down in Firle. He's never locked the door of his vicarage. It's always slightly ajar. If you need to see him at 3 a.m. and you're in a jam, you can. If you're homeless, you sleep in the church. God almighty, is nobody reading the Gospels anymore? That's the fucking memo. You know, that's the memo. You know, and it's so radical when you see somebody actually having a bit of Jesus around them. So, I digress. Excuse me for the profanities. It's only out of passion. So I then thought, oh, no, I'm going to have to go to church. Oh, no. So I went to a Catholic church and it was Pentecost. And I've got lots of Catholic friends. But the priest who was running it and said, and now we come to the tongues of fire. And I was like, Okay, I'm off, you know. You don't want that in the middle of it. So that wasn't for me. But then I went on, and I want to petition for the power of a place called Bovey Tracy Baptist Church. Bovey Tracy Baptist Church was the first place where I saw builders coming in who'd obviously with children hanging off them. They've got the dust. They've obviously been straight off the site, you know, in tears, in prayer, like really having an encounter with something wonderful. And it was packed. It was packed. So I thought, okay, there's something going on with the Baptist, but I still can't do this. And I went on and I went on. And then one day I was in the middle of a shopping center in Exeter. And in the middle of the shopping center is this one tiny little Anglo-Saxon building that they can't knock down. So it's surrounded by shops selling pornography and vapes and drugs. And then right in the middle is this little Russian Orthodox church. So I walked straight into the middle of something called Divine Liturgy. And the runway between heaven and earth just went bang. And I, in the second hour of that experience, I had somehow journeyed beyond Bethlehem, back before Abraham, I am, back before the Lascaux Caves, back into the Sophia rhythm that takes you to the beginning of things. Something of that announced itself in that service. So I found something in the Orthodox tradition, which I didn't expect. I didn't think, I don't need lots of men with beards and loads of rules. Like, I'm not attracted to that. But the simple power of what they're getting up to. And then, of course, when I got in there and I realized the whole church was being run by female friends of mine as well, and it was a real back and forth. Things, go and have a look. Go and have a look, because things are rarely how they appear from the outside. But there's something very powerful for me going on in that. But I had to go and look in a variety of places.
Will you join me in giving a huge round of applause for Martin Shaw?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.